start a few minutes early, as there seems to be a lot of people blocking the doorway, so no one else can get in anyway. Thanks for all for coming. My name is Mark Agar. I work at our Microsoft's corporate offices in Redmond in our environmental sustainability team. And how many, just curious, how many folks have in their companies have an environmental sustainability team? Anybody? Nobody. Wow. I'm definitely unique today in that respect, I guess. I focus on technology strategy, which means that I think about and help evangelize both internally and externally. We've got some more people coming in. The role of technology to help us live more sustainably, what we call IT for green. And then the other thing, which is what we're going to be talking about today, greener IT, driving. Wow, come on in. I might have to start this again. I guess you all got stuck in the line. Can we reset the clock and wipe the tape? It's a lot of last minute, folks. I still have a minute to go. What do you think? Should we wait another minute or not? Should we just get going again? Anybody? Wait one more minute? Just got like 20 people came in the last second, so. Can you reset the clock so I start from scratch? All right, we'll get going now. So thanks everybody for coming again. Sorry if I'm repeating this for the folks already in the room. My name is Mark Agar. I work in our environmental sustainability team in Microsoft's head offices in Redmond, Washington. Don't let the accent fool you. My role is on technology strategy, and I focus on IT for green, which is helping us use technology to live more sustainably. And what I'm going to be talking about today, green IT or greener IT, and that is essentially using energy and other resources more efficiently in order to basically save money and help the environment at the same time. So I don't know how many of you sort of think about this on a day-to-day basis, but it seems that we are running into a little bit of a problem. Oh, there's my reminders. Thank you very much. Should already shut down Outlook. We'll see what happens. The interesting fact here is that IT energy consumption is growing 12 times faster than overall energy use, which gives you an indication of more about the growth of IT in the sense that we're ever so slowly and actually increasingly rapidly digitizing the universe, literally the universe. We have a project actually at Microsoft called Worldwide Telescope, which is doing just that. But more pertinently, we're moving from a world of shipping heavy nuclei to just electrons, where you're using technology to do that. So, as that growing demand sort of starts being felt by individual organizations, they're running into constraints. Obviously, the threat and actual rising energy costs. What's interesting here, every time I come to Europe, it's kind of more fun for me because energy prices are more expensive, so I feel like I have a stronger message. Literally, prices in Europe are about twice as much as they are in the U.S. So it actually, motivates people to focus on this a bit more. Obviously, tight budgets are an everlasting concern. And one thing that most people don't think about, but is actually quite pertinent, especially for folks who own large data centers, is that you have limited electric power availability. We actually don't generally have a shortage of energy. We have a shortage of power. And the distinction is, for those of you that don't know, is that energy is essentially power over time. And power is the instantaneous generation of electricity. And so if you're not careful about when you consume the energy, if everyone like turns on their air conditioner at the same time, like they do at 3 o'clock in the afternoon in the southern parts of the US, you have a major power shortage. And power shortages can manifest themselves in two ways. Either you have a lack of generation capacity, for at any given point, or you actually have a transmission constraint, and you can't actually get the power to the folks that need it. And that's typically, that last part is the thing that data center owners face more often when they're trying to expand, but they also run into those issues at certain times of day. And there are scenarios where utilities will ask power consumers to subscribe to what they call demand response events, and for a reduced electricity rate, the utility will get the right to call you up and say, you need to shed load, in the next half an hour to avoid a brownout. And so that can become problematic for a data center owner because, like, well, what do I shut down? Do I just peanut butter the load reduction across all of my properties, or can I be a little bit more deliberate about how I actually shut down certain services and non-critical tasks? So we'll talk a little bit about that in a bit. Obviously, regulations are an ever-threatening problem. The EU is particularly interested in the amount of energy that IT is using, particularly with its growth. And obviously, there are major e-waste concerns, which I'll talk about a little bit later. So this really points to a need for IT organizations, which very much includes the developers, to sort of add a third leg to the stool, if you like, of the key IT tenets, which are reliability and security typically. But now we really need to start thinking about being energy efficient. And it's necessary for everybody, from the vendors all the way down to the individual practitioners and the developers, to really sort of embrace energy efficiency as a fundamental part of their responsibilities. So why would you care? Well, I think I've probably addressed most of this, but along with reduced operating expenditures through reduced energy use, there's a great opportunity to reduce the amount you actually spend on hardware, both in terms of servers and even storage. But if you're building a data center and you're able to utilize the resources in that data center more effectively, you actually don't need to buy as many servers. And as a result, you don't have to throw as many away in 3 years. You'll have a lot fewer constraints if you utilize your resources more effectively. And ultimately, that means greater IT capacity with your existing resources. And so there's lots of good reasons to do it. I mean, obviously, the economic drivers should be apparent for most, but regardless of sort of where you sit on the whole spectrum of the environment, you'll pretty much find a reason for anybody. So I like to break down the IT energy efficiency opportunities into the various layers of the stack here. And this is a stack that's specifically thinking about energy. So if you look from the bottom layer, we go from silicon all the way up to the building. And you could actually argue that there's another layer, which is the cloud. But the cloud is really just an external representation of the same thing here. So I thought it was somewhat redundant. But you can think of the cloud as being just like a parallel version of this diagram. So if we look at the various opportunities, at the bottom layer, we obviously have energy-efficient silicon. Now, whether that's variable power components such as CPUs with dynamic voltage frequency scaling, or even low power components such as what you call green RAM, which is essentially DRAM that uses a lot less energy than the previous generation. At the operating system layer, we have power management, which actually interacts directly with the hardware and is responsible for helping the silicon get to those lower power states. We have at the application layer, and this is an area obviously I want to be spending some time on today. We have what I would call energy smart applications, so applications that are smart about how they use energy and when they use energy. And then that energy actually translates into the amount of resources they're using, because obviously those resources use energy. For IT folks, they really need to think about how they actually configure systems. And this is obviously dependent a lot on the type of application that you're deploying on them. And so there's a good opportunity for developers and IT folks to get together to really figure out what's the optimal configuration for a system. In many cases today, you'll find that the servers are typically starved of I/O capability, typically to the disk or maybe even to the network, where there's an excess of CPU capacity that essentially can't be utilized. And you know, traditionally, a lot of people have like bought, well, I've got a server, I'll buy two CPUs. Well, if you think about it, they're probably only using one or two cores on that you know, 8-core CPU today, so they have another 14 cores or so completely idle. So why did they buy two processors? Could they have bought a lower power processor? At the management layer, we obviously have virtualization, which is a primary technology to help drive up utilization, but as we'll see later, it's not certainly not the be-all and end-all. And then on the PC side, we have centralized power management, which is really about leveraging the power management capabilities of the operating system to make sure that it's doing its job and that users aren't just arbitrarily turning it off. And then at the building layer, we have efficiencies in the power and cooling infrastructure. And that's commonly reflected by a metric called PUE. Who here is familiar with PUE before I tell you what it is? Anybody? Wow, okay, cool. I got to tell you all about PUE. So PUE stands for power usage effectiveness. It's a metric that's supported by the green grid. Anyone know who green grid is? Oh, this is so good. So green grid is an organization that's focused on IT efficiency, and actually their historical focus, and actually most focus, has been around data center power and cooling efficiency. And so PUE, power usage effectiveness, is the ratio of the amount of power that goes into a data center versus the amount that's actually used by the IT infrastructure. And we find today that most data centers with traditional designs have a PUE of about 2.0, which means they're using, for every watt that's being consumed by hardware, there's another watt associated with power and cooling, and most of it's typically associated with cooling. So there's a good opportunity there to dramatically reduce the power and cooling overhead of data centers. Now, a PUE of 1.0, which is sort of nirvana, would essentially mean you've got a data center in a tent outside with no lights. So obviously that's not going to be a good solution for many people. But we have seen some fairly significant improvements using techniques like free air cooling, where you're literally just sucking in outside cooler air and then venting it outside instead of actually using power to condition the air before it goes through the systems. We're also, folks are experimenting with just higher intake temperatures. So, if anyone's walked into a data center, you'll go, why is it so cold in here? Well, the reality is you don't need to make data centers that cold with modern hardware. And ultimately, you really want a scenario where you don't want humans in the data center because it's too hot to work. And that would save a lot of energy just, from the get-go. The goal really is to have a data center in a desert with no air conditioning. And I think we're actually moving to that point, so you're going to see very low PUEs with those sorts of designs. And so, so how do we, actually improve efficiency? Well, the good news is that IT vendors are really responding pretty aggressively to the opportunity and the problems associated with it. So we've seen over the last few years that, computer hardware, both PCs and servers, while they're getting more performant, and more capacity, disks, etc., they're actually using less energy, as an overall package. Now, there are some configurations that we see today where that isn't necessarily true, because as you add more cores to a system, you need a lot more memory to support those cores, and as a result, the actual power footprint of the machine goes up. But the capacity of that machine to do work is, you know, exponentially greater. System management and virtualization solutions. I'm sure you're mostly familiar with virtualization. There are technologies now to obviously to manage the virtualization, dynamically move virtual instances from machine to machine without anyone necessarily noticing, if you're an end user. And then systems management software, you know, similarly provision hardware dynamically, you know, all sorts of things that you can help you drive up your utilization and manage power. And then the cloud is another pretty significant recent advance in helping drive up overall IT efficiency. And the fundamental reason for that is because the cloud providers are motivated to make money off IT. And the only really way to make money off IT versus how you make money is to be more efficient, because you can't sacrifice security or reliability. So the way you make the margin is by becoming more efficient. So you'll see the large, you know, cloud providers, including Microsoft, have a real strong and almost, you know, crazy focus on efficiency to really drive down the cost without actually sacrificing, you know, security and reliability. But there's still a little bit of a problem. And that problem, frankly, is that while all those technologies exist and are available for IT practitioners and IT, you know, IT departments to use, we're really not doing a good job of necessarily implementing them. When we look at the typical data center, and a typical data center I would characterize as a PUE of 2.0 and a utilization of about 7%. Now, I noticed on the slide it says 15 to 20%. That's what studies report. If you talk to any individual customer, they'll, you know, admit that they're probably about half as good as the studies suggest. So if you take those factors together, what that means is that for every 100 watts that go into the data center, only 3 watts are actually doing any form of work whatsoever, which is pretty appalling when you think about it. Now, certainly, you're never going to get to 100% energy productivity because, you know, the dynamics of the workloads just would never allow you to do that. But I'm pretty sure you'd all agree that we can probably do a little bit better than 3%. Especially when you consider like 15% of servers are typically idle. Now, this is an interesting graph that allows you to sort of visualize the effect of various energy efficiency efforts. So if you look at the bottom two lines here, the green line and the red line, that's PUE and power supply efficiency. And so if you just said, I'm just going to focus on PUE and I'm going to take my PUE from 2.0 to 1.2, which is a very significant thing and frankly would be impossible for an existing data center to go from a 2.0 to a 1.2. You'd need to build a new data center to do that with a dramatically different architecture. You can see you take your energy productivity from about just over 2% to just under 4%. So not particularly impressive, and that would require a very significant investment to do that. Similarly with power supply efficiency. But then if you look at utilization, because we're starting so low on utilization, around, you know, 7%, I mean, you could be generous and say it's 15%, you don't, you know, it's the benefits of focusing on utilization are so much greater than anything else that you kind of wonder, well, why haven't we, you know, been focusing more on that? The reality is until you get to 50% utilization, that's what's when, you know, the difference between focusing on PUE and utilization actually narrows. So you might be asking yourself, well, wasn't virtualization supposed to address this? Well, that certainly helped to some degree, and it's, you know, we've managed to virtualize, you know, the industry, the practitioners have managed to virtualize a fair number of completely idle servers. But, you know, fundamentally, a lot of the virtualization projects stalled during the economic downturn. And the other challenge is that, frankly, the hardware performance is outpacing the ability to consolidate. You know, every 18 months or so, you're seeing, you know, a doubling of transistor density, which means that really your density of virtual machines to any one machine should double. But for one reason or another, IT pros are not in that mindset that they're you know, willing to double their density of virtual machines every couple of years. And there's some probably pretty good rational reasons for that. And one of the reasons is that they don't really have a clue what's going on with the applications inside those virtual machines. And so they can't reliably consolidate something that could, you know, potentially spike in its utilization without their knowledge and potentially be starved of resources. So the perceived risk of consolidating those apps is really too great, and we see that a lot with you know, various line of business apps that are owned by business units, and they're really hesitant to actually consolidate. So there is a role here for apps, which we'll talk about in a second. I just wanted to sort of swing back to PCs, as we'll be talking about this a fair amount in a minute. PCs are pretty bad too. If you think about sort of the role of a PC, whether that's a laptop or a desktop, it's really designed to be idle for most of its life. And that's actually, that 75% figure is very generous, because the way our OS engineers characterize idle is the time between keystrokes when you're typing. So it's probably idle 99.9999% of the time, but this on a gross level, it's at least 75% of the time when it's off, you know, or on, but not being used. Either that's at the weekend or, you know, at night. You know, users do have to sleep, of course. So the other problem is that, you know, even though we've had operating system power management have automatic sleep on by default, many of them are configured not to sleep. IT pros traditionally turn sleep off when they deploy machines for one reason or another. And then the other challenge is that sleep is often undermined by applications. So while you may go to the effort of actually deploying power management on the machines and monitoring it and it's enforced, etc., a lot of times users will walk away expecting their machines to sleep, and they won't, because an app, for one reason or another, has inadvertently kept the machine awake. Sometimes it will keep it awake for legitimate reasons, but it would seem that the majority of the time it's not necessary. So we'll spend a fair amount of time talking about that too. So this is what I call my guilt slide. And you know, if the economic arguments and, you know, the productivity arguments don't get you, then maybe this one will. So if you think about a server, or even a PC, but a server I think is probably the most stark example. You know, you buy it. It costs you, you know, thousands of dollars to buy. You put it in the data center. It costs you thousands of dollars to run it, but it's really not doing anything for most of its life. And then it ends up as e-waste. And maybe a third of e-waste is diverted and actually responsibly dealt with. The rest of it ends up in somewhere like this, with, you know, unprotected workers dismantling it, burning stuff over an open flame to, you know, get the metals off. It's polluting the environment. It's harming the people who live there, and it's frankly unnecessary. You know, the amount of e-waste that we could avoid if we actually more effectively utilized our computing resources would be dramatic. And so this is the one thing that, you know, I think the regulators look at and go, you know, A, we've got to solve the e-waste problem, but then we also have to think about the supply of e-waste and what can we do. The other thing, and this is sort of a little bit off topic, but I'll bring this up sort of as a public service announcement, is that if you have an old computer, especially an old PC, if you buy a new one to replace it, recycle that new one as soon as you can, because there's a good chance that it will still have a useful life somewhere in the developing world or in school or something like that. If you just hold on to it and stick it in your closet for a long period of time, then ultimately you're going to get rid of it and it'll be too slow and too old for anyone to use. So we can actually dramatically sort of improve the utilization of that machine if you recycle it much sooner. So a little bit of a diversion there. We were having that discussion last night at dinner. So what are the inhibitors to improving utilization? If I've talked about virtualization, it hasn't really solved it. So the one thing that we notice is that, you know, if IT departments don't control all the IT infrastructure, which they generally don't, it's very hard for them to actually own the problem and, you know, virtualize the applications and do all the other necessary steps. And so IT organizations really have to think about their role in terms of running IT as a utility and not, you know, just being a landlord for a bunch of servers that they don't have any insight or control over. But the other big thing is that applications really are not designed, and no one's ever asked a developer to do this, to help optimize IT resource utilization. And you know, so this is really, this is the message of the day, is that there is a role for developers, either if you're developing applications for PCs or for the cloud, whether that's private or public, or even just, you know, the odd server. There are things that you should be aware of and ultimately to be doing in order to help drive up that utilization and reduce that big pile of e-waste. So I mentioned just now about treating IT as a utility. I wanted to provide some context for, you know, this is what I was telling the IT folks yesterday at the TechNet Live event. You know, they need to transition to a service provider and not be just a landlord for those servers and offer compute and storage rather than hardware. So ultimately, and I think this is actually something that would resonate with a lot of folks, is that why does a developer, especially who's writing the cloud, really want to know about OS instances? I don't think that's really that interesting for most people. You just want a service that provides compute and storage and the stuff that fits in between, and will give you some form of assurance that your application will finish in a timely manner and, you know, have the necessary response times, et cetera, et cetera. I think there's a lot of productivity benefit that would come from something like that. That's a little bit further off than perhaps I would like, but certainly something that we're considering. But I think in the meantime, if we can just get developers and even the business units away from the hardware and more into, I'm just going to rent some compute cycles, and maybe that's reflected as an OS instance, that will actually be a great step in the right direction. Adopting the private or public cloud, the reality is it doesn't matter to an end user or even to a developer or a business unit where the physical infrastructure is, as long as it's reliable and secure and fits all the regulatory requirements. That's really all that matters. And so the IT department being a front to that service, they can figure out how to manage resources and where they should be located in the back end. Centralizing the CapEx and decentralizing the OpEx, that's really just a way of saying, give me the money for your servers and I'll give you some credits to buy the compute and storage. Reflecting all the costs to make sure the power and the energy and the build-out costs are all there, and also adopting similar principles for client compute environments. So that was really just as context for, you know, the world in which I would like to see IT moving, and then, you know, it's less about, you know, people caring about what servers they have, which is sort of ridiculous. The benefits of cloud computing, I've touched on this already, but, you know, ultimately if you move some applications of the cloud, then if you're constrained on power, and then you potentially are freeing that up, or you could just turn it off and save on the energy costs. Paying only for what you use, that's sort of one of the fundamental principles, and that actually is pretty significant for a developer in the sense that if you have an idle application that's provisioned across, you know, hundreds or thousands of OS instances, you're just wasting money. And actually designing the application to dynamically scale based on its utilization would actually be quite beneficial for the bottom line. So obviously, you know, it helps you avoid underutilized equipment, especially if you're a small organization. Most small organizations just don't have the user base to drive the utilization that a modern server can provide. And so, you know, if you've got probably less than, if you know, probably 500 people in your organization, you have to wonder, why do I even really need a server? Shouldn't I just be using the cloud? Certainly that's going to be a process to wean yourself off your old legacy apps, but it's a direction that people should be moving. And then ultimately, you know, if you do this, you can reduce overall energy use for running IT and the associated carbon emissions by up to 90%, particularly if you're a small org. For large orgs, we just did this study with Accenture, who's a consulting company, and WSP, an environmental organization, that showed up to, let's say, 90% for small orgs and up to just 30% for large organizations. So it's pretty significant, and you know, obviously the cloud infrastructures and the vendors behind that who are driving efficiency is what's responsible, along with multi-tenancy and other things. So as you probably guessed by now, been leading up to this, you know, we really really see applications as the missing link in IT efficiency. It can't happen to the potential it can without the applications working in conjunction with both the hardware, the operating system, and the management infrastructure that manages that. So what are some of the key sort of characteristics of energy efficient apps? So on the PC especially, you need to make sure that you support sleep. Actually, can I get a quick show of hands? Who here writes applications that run on PCs? Oh, love it. I've got some stuff for you. Who writes applications that run on servers? Okay, so it's like, well, it's almost the same people who put their hands up. So supporting sleep is a critical thing. And the good news is there's not a whole lot you have to do. It's just really about being aware that you could potentially undermine sleep. The other thing, which is going to become very, 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 can I say very again? Very important in the future, is this low power idle state. This is something that is going to become very prevalent in Windows 8 timeframe with ARM-based system on a chip devices. These things are designed based on the low power profile to last all day. However, an application can fundamentally kill that value proposition by not being respectful of idle. There's going to be things that will happen in the operating system to sort of force you down that path, and potentially you'll have a bad experience as a end user if you use one of these applications which doesn't support low power idle. But you know, at the same time, if right now, for instance, this is an idle state. There's nothing going on the screen. Really, there shouldn't be for most apps. If this was an ARM-based laptop, it should be using a very small amount of energy right now to just essentially just power the screen and pretty much nothing else. So this is going to be a key area for you, and you'll see more guidance for this sort of as we get closer to the Windows 8 timeframe. But I'm going to give you sort of a sneak preview of what we're asking for today. On the server side, by the way, that's also important for server apps as well, because especially in a virtualized environment, if you've got hundreds of virtual machines, you don't want to just be doing a bunch of stuff for no good reason, and just using resources when another application might find them useful. Not requiring dedicated IT infrastructure. That really is a statement about servers, and I think there's this expectation amongst server developers that, well, just give me all the stuff I need, and I have no idea how much I need, but I'm sure you'll provide whatever my application requires. And ultimately, you don't want to make that assumption, and you don't want to make that assumption that your application is always going to have the same amount of resources at any given point in time. That IT could be attempting to give a portion of your unused resources to somebody else, and may want to constrain your growth through one mechanism or another, while those resources are being used for something else. Also, using application designs that don't require you to have expensive and dedicated hardware for high availability. I know this is a little tricky with stateful applications, but certainly if your application is stateless, that should actually be quite easy to do these days without too much effort. Scaling your use of IT resources with the load. We are looking at various mechanisms through Microsoft Research for doing this, and I'll talk about that in a bit. But ultimately, you really want to try to help the IT organization, and particularly through management infrastructure and instrumentation, to be aware of the types of resources your application needs through telemetry that gives them an indication of, is our response times acceptable right now, for instance. Right now it's like they just have no clue. I asked this question yesterday. I said, who has any idea what's going on in any application they're running? And nobody put their hand up. I mean, they just don't know what's happening with those applications. And the other thing, which is, I think, going to become, and I sort of talked about this already a little bit, but is responding to energy availability. I talked about the demand response scenario, where suddenly the utility will call up and say, you need to reduce load now. Well, if your application was able to indicate what parts of it were critical and what parts weren't, you could potentially have those parts shut down on a signal from the IT administrator, and then your application will continue working as far as the end user is concerned just fine, and then you can pick up on the non-critical work later when that constraint was removed. So data centers are going to be, hopefully quite different in the future. We're already starting to see metering of hardware, and that's actually necessary if you want to calculate what your PUE is. You want to know how much power is being used by your IT infrastructure. But we really need to start moving to a world where we're actually metering the applications, and those applications are providing, you know, are instrumented to provide that telemetry data so that you know how well they're performing and what, you know, and infer what types of resources they need. You want to be able to control them, which we already talked about. And then one particular technique is to be able to use finer-grained units of service delivery. So rather than big monolithic chunks of code, if you can, we think about actually breaking them up into smaller pieces and instantiating those as and when we need. That will help you dynamically scale the application in a much more smooth way, as opposed to, well, now I need another instance, another OS instance. I should just scale it up over time and scale it back down when necessary. And then I mentioned already deferring that non-critical work at times of high load or when energy is constrained, etc. So there's a couple of research projects I want to talk about. I'm not going to go into great detail about these because you can actually go online and dig into this yourself. But there's a project right now, and both of these are publicly viewable. They aren't publicly available, but you'll at least be able to see the concepts. One of them is called Marlow. And the goal of Marlow is, it's sort of, I really view it as the first step in allowing that dynamic scalability and making it easier for IT in particular to control the infrastructure. Now, their original goal was to be able to take something like Azure or Messenger or even our compute cluster and literally turn machines off if they weren't necessary, but turn them back on ahead of anticipated load. And that's really critical because you don't want to be behind the curve, because otherwise your response times are going to go down the toilet. So they have an algorithm which they've proved, looking at historical data, is literally almost as good as hindsight. So if you had, you know, if you were literally able to see the future, you would, and you used an algorithm that could see the future, it's literally, the Marlow algorithm is literally almost as good in terms of being able to bring those machines up and then turn them back off. And so one of the things that, you know, we've talked about with the Marlow team is how much better could you be if you weren't just relying on the gross metrics that the hardware provides, such as CPU utilization and CPU queue lengths and that sort of stuff, but actually have the applications instrumented and providing that information to you. And the answer is way better. Because it's very hard to know, you know, where an application is constrained on resources. And so you typically have to sort of, you know, hedge and over-provision the application in order to sort of guarantee an acceptable performance for that app. And so this project really points to the importance and getting the applications better instrumented. Now, I just want to take a step back and say no one here is suggesting that we go back and re-instrument all the existing apps. Clearly, you know, people have suggested that in the past and they've been laughed out of the room. But the reality is that if you think about the applications that were in, the number of apps that were written 10 years ago versus the number of apps being written today versus the number of apps that are being written, you know, in 10 years' time, you're going to see way more apps in the future than we have today. It's kind of like the amount of books that were published before, you know, the Second World War. You know, there's more words written every day, if probably not more, every day now than there were in the entirety of human civilization before World War II. So we're seeing a similar phenomena with applications, that more and more apps are being developed. So there's ample opportunity. We don't have to go, oh man, I can't do this for my existing apps, I'm just not going to bother. We want to embrace the opportunity now and then really go forward with these principles. So just this is a little example of the types of power savings. So they instrumented, actually what they didn't, this isn't like based on an actual product or production environment. What they did though was they looked at the telemetry data from the past and ran it through the algorithm, and you can see that like the optimal case where you've got you know 20/20 hindsight was essentially as good as the algorithm, the Marlow algorithm for all cases in terms of energy saved. Now, if you look here, this is like 2.5 megawatt hours of energy savings over a day, and this is about 500 servers. Now, there's two ways of looking at that. You go, wow, 2.5 megawatt hours, that's potentially a lot of money I could save on electricity. The other way, which I prefer to look at, is, well, that's 2.5 megawatts of additional capacity that you didn't have to buy in order to do more work. And so for organizations that are constrained on resources, or organizations that simply feel that if they had more compute power, they could be more competitive, that's really a very compelling value proposition. Because what that means essentially is that I know ahead of time that there's a certain part of the day in which I can claim back resources from idle applications and put other applications on them which aren't constrained in terms of the time they need to run, and then take them off and then let the application, you know, go back into that space. So that's really going to be something that I think is that IT organizations will start demanding, especially, you know, if you think about like the finance sector, who, you know, essentially say, look, you just give us compute capacity and we'll take it. But they have a lot of applications which sit there idle for all of the time that they aren't confident or comfortable sort of removing resources from. So if you could give them that extra virtual capacity, I think they'd value that quite dramatically, especially given that a lot of these organizations are already power constrained. So there's another project which is sort of a layer above, and these projects are actually all being developed by the same team at Microsoft Research, called Orleans. And you can think of Orleans as essentially a .NET for Azure. That's a sort of a loose way of describing it. But the goal here is to provide a higher abstraction layer for developers so that they don't need to worry about OS instances, and that they can actually focus on business logic. And the framework allows them to write applications and, you know, essentially, you know, define the constraints and the contracts they want with the framework. And there's this runtime which actually is responsible for scheduling what we call grains across the Orleans fabric. And so these grains are individual instances of work, and these things will replicate or be replicated as and when is needed based on the amount of throughput you need for a system. And this works both on client and server, so you can use the Orleans framework on a client and a server and have those things communicate across the internet. So this is very complicated, and frankly is probably more complicated than I can really adequately express in this session, but I highly encourage you to go check out the paper, because this is a view of where I think we need to go with regards to cloud computing in order to really maximize the effectiveness of the resources that we have up in the cloud. And of course, this is something you would also potentially be able to use on the private cloud as well in your own infrastructure, so it's not just a public thing. So I think it's a very exciting and promising thing, and I'd encourage you to check that out some more. Now we're doing 35 minutes. All right, so I'm going to drill now a bit into PC system power management. So I think I already talked about sleep and sort of the importance of that. It's just useful to remember that, you know, that system sleep uses about a tenth of the power of the active idle machine, at least for a desktop. That actually is changing slightly, especially with these newer, lower power form factors. In fact, it wouldn't surprise me if we see a day when you'll see laptops sort of acting a little bit like phones, and essentially don't go to sleep when they're not being used. They just go to a very low power state. But certainly for desktops, and especially like for home servers and things like that, a sleep mode can actually be a very significant energy saver. And as you can see here, the amount of savings that you can get if you have a lot of PCs, a lot of desktop PCs, can really start to add up. But there are some problems with sleep. Unfortunately, the way sleep is designed, it hasn't been particularly easy to understand why it's not working as it should be. But the good news is we actually have some tools now in Windows 7 that allow IT pros and tech enthusiasts to figure out what's going on, and that's a problem for application developers who write apps on PCs, because someone's going to come knocking on your door. The other challenge is the system display will go off when it shouldn't. So this is the inverse of the problem. As we move to more and more aggressive, say, screen blanking timeouts, it starts to become more annoying to users if applications don't explicitly request that the display stay awake while they're rendering content to the screen, particularly in passive viewing scenarios, where I click on a YouTube clip and I sit back, And then 2 minutes later, my screen dims. It's like, oh, crap, I hit the shift key. And then every 2 minutes, I'm doing that. So that's very annoying to the user. And what typically happens then is they will change the display timeout so it's greater, which means they're saving less energy and their battery life is reduced. So it becomes really important for the developer to sort of actually make sure that they understand how their application is going to be used and raise the appropriate requests to keep the components on. And then the other challenge, sort of getting back to that low power idle thing, is that the system just drains power way quicker than it should. And so in Windows, we have this thing called the system timer. And historically, people have been kind of lazy with system timer. If they ever have like fast, you know, animation that's occurring on the screen, they'll just go, oh, we should just change the timer to 1 millisecond, which is essentially the lowest you can change it. Which means that the interrupts scheduler runs more frequently, which means your animations will probably be smoother. Well, the interesting thing is with modern hardware, you don't need a 1 millisecond timer resolution anymore. Most of the time, you can get away with the default timer resolution, which is 15.6. So it's 15.6 times less frequent as 1 millisecond. So you can, every time you get a timer interrupt, it essentially wakes the whole processor up. It takes it out of a deep sleep state, a deep low power state, and brings it back up into P0, which means it's not saving energy. So this is going to be very important in the future for these low power devices. And of course, the other problem is 100% CPU utilization. As I was coming over from the US on the plane, I was actually developing one of these decks, and before I sort of really got into it, I checked my CPU utilization. It was 100%, and because I think it was the virus scanner actually decided it was going to go do some scanning, you know, on battery. It's like, no power source, thanks a lot, you know. And I had to like shut it down. Man, it was a pain to shut it down, but I'm going to be making a phone call to those guys when I get back. But if I had let that run, instead of having 3 hours battery life, I'd have probably been at about an hour, which would have been not very productive for this trip. So all sorts of important things. Now, this is something that you should be very afraid of. We like to call this the wall of shame. You don't want your application to be on the wall of shame. This is a report from System Center Configuration Manager 2007 R3. We like short names for our products. So these are the applications that have raised availability requests when the system is otherwise idle. So these are actually keeping the machine awake. Now, some of these may be legitimate. Some of them probably aren't. We don't really have a good way to deterministically determine whether a availability request is legitimate or not. But you know, if you start seeing an application on here a lot, there's probably a good chance that it's not entirely legitimate. Now, most of these, this is like just the top 10 list or whatever, are actually system services. USB audio, that's a classic. A lot of applications will not close the audio channel when they're done playing audio, which means with USB audio, the machine will stay awake until that application is typically manually closed. That's a big problem because you play a audio clip and walk away from your desk and maybe you don't come back until Monday morning, and you find your machine stayed awake all over the weekend. So lots of good reasons to stay off that list. So if we look at the availability requests, I'm going to change the order of this because I think it probably would be more useful. So if I go to the command prompt, so there is a utility that shipped in Windows 7 called PowerCFG, and there is a useful switch that we added in Windows 7 called requests. So, aha, what do you know? So I do a PowerCFG request. I've got two availability requests. These are actually very legitimate. This is PowerPoint saying, hey, you're doing a presentation. I need the display to stay awake. It would really suck if my display kept going off during the presentation. So that's a good use of availability request. Similarly, probably don't want my machine to go to sleep while I'm doing this. So actually, that system availability request is a little bit redundant, because if there's a display availability request, it will keep the machine awake because the display needs to stay awake. Of course, if I come out of presentation mode, both of those requests should disappear. In fact, why don't we do that just to prove it? So let's come out of here. Come back. There you go. Boom. Gone. So that PowerPoint actually works as expected. Now, there is a tool that we ship in the driver kit, and it's actually source code. Let me find that. Called PowerMon. And it's actually just source code which you can compile. But the great thing is it's the source code you can look to see the various methods of actually setting or creating, setting, and clearing power requests. And so this is a little GUI tool which lets me actually manually do that. So I can set a system availability request. I can set a display availability request. And I can do this weird thing called an away mode request. And I'll tell you what that's all about in a minute. But if I go back to the command prompt and run PowerShift C, so there we go. So we see PowerMon, because this is the app that's doing it, has requested all three of these things. Now, there is an ability in Windows 7, and it's highly recommended, to set a reason code, which will give an IT pro or anyone running this tool the ability to see, okay, why has this application raised an availability request? So that can be very useful for debugging purposes and can, frankly, keep you out of jail, so to speak, in terms of, yes, this is really legitimate. The user is doing something, and I don't want the machine or the display to go off. So unfortunately, this instance of PowerMon doesn't expose that for one reason or another. The away mode request is interesting because, unlike a system availability request, which will keep the machine awake if the user just walks away from it, if you just had a system availability request and you put your machine to sleep, it would the machine would just go off. And so as an application, you can't assume that you can veto sleep using a system availability request. However, the away mode request is for the very, 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 did I say very enough? Very rare circumstance in which you absolutely must keep the machine awake or data loss will occur if the user tries to put the machine to sleep. Now, there are two and only two examples I can think of, and maybe you can think of others. One is recording TV or like live streaming media. Obviously, going to sleep while that's happening would cause data loss. In other words, you'd lose part of the program. And the other is actually burning a disk, which generally is a destructive event if you stop it in the middle and you just end up with a shiny coaster. So that's one reason to use an away mode request. And I'll show you what happens. So normally if I hit the sleep button, my machine would actually dutifully go to sleep. But because I have this away mode request, I put it to sleep. The screen blanks. And I go, whoa, it's gone to sleep. But it really hasn't. It's just pretending to be asleep. As soon as I hit the shift key, boom, there it is again. So it came back. Of course, it decides to lock the computer because it just pretended to wake up from sleep. So that's a useful technique if you can think of a scenario, but instead I can't think of any others than those two. Anybody got any suggestions for a scenario where you might use an away mode request other than those two? That's a good one. Yeah. Now there are capabilities in Windows to actually roll back if you're doing file system changes. You can use the TFS transaction file system and actually just set up, start a transaction, do whatever you're doing. Windows, when it boots, will go, whoa, there's something weird happened here, and it'll roll everything back. But actually, it's probably not a bad thing to do. You probably shouldn't be doing a Windows upgrade on battery, unless you're really brave. Do one on the plane next time, maybe. So that's availability requests sort of in all their glory. So let me go back to the PowerPoint here. Which one is it? This one. There we go. All right. So I think I covered all of this. So I think just some key tips here. So, don't prevent sleep unless it's really critical. I mean, don't just do this because who knows what might happen. Just assume that the system will go to sleep frequently, and you only want to do this raise an availability request if it's going to impact productivity in some material way. Also, the other thing to be really aware of is indirect availability requests that you may raise, and the classic one of these are on the file system, accessing files over the network, or audio. We saw that USB audio and RDBSS, which was the first one in the list. They're both common causes of insomnia. You open a file over the network, you leave it open for write, the machine never goes to sleep as a result. So you probably don't want to keep files open for write across the network unnecessarily. Similarly, close audio channels when you're done with them. Use that display availability request in passive viewing scenarios. That could be quite, video conferencing, or if you're, it doesn't have to be like full screen presentation mode. But keep in mind that if this isn't something that the user is going to be sitting back from the keyboard, you probably don't need to use an availability request on the display, because the chances are their keystrokes will keep the display awake anyway. And ultimately, if you're not actively rendering to the screen, the moment you stop doing that, then clear the availability request on the display, because you want that display to go off. The display is actually the biggest consumer of energy, particularly on a desktop, with these modern lower power desktops, and also on the mobile device. Although that's actually changing. There's some actually pretty interesting technologies coming along to dramatically reduce the display power. So here's some code samples. You can see there that you're requesting the power request, and there's the reason code up there. System needed to burn a CD, for instance. And then you actually set it when you start the burn, and you clear it the moment you finish. So it's a pretty simple construct to wrap your existing code around. I think we talked about accidental insomnia. One thing to consider is, if you're considering keeping the machine awake, think about well, is this a task which is going to take a long time to run? Maybe you shouldn't start it if you're on battery. Like doing a big virus scan, for instance. So you can actually monitor. In fact, that if I bring back the where is it? PowerMon, which is a great icon. So you can see I'm connected to AC power right now. If I unplug, running on battery. So you can actually register for an event that will let you know that that's happened. And you can also just query it before you start your application to make sure that that's not necessarily going to be the case. You probably don't want to start a long-running, power-hungry task when you're on battery, or at least warn the user ahead of time before you do that. All right, so we showed Power CFG requests, so I don't need to do that. There is another tool which I'm not going to go into, because it's interesting but not particularly that relevant for you guys. It's Power CFG /energy. The one thing that this will show you though is the timer resolution, and whether or not there's an application. It'll actually do a stack trace to try and figure out what app is keeping the timer resolution at lower than default. And so you don't want to be in that list either. Okay, talked about the passive interaction. Sleep resume. Now this is a really interesting one. So because I mentioned that sleep can happen at any moment, it also is a problem when you're resuming. I notice on my own laptop that it suffers from what I call the Mondays. If I put it to sleep on a Thursday and wake it up on a Friday, it's pretty quick at resuming and pretty responsive soon after I've woken it up. On Monday, for whatever reason, it's really sluggish. And it's probably because there are a lot of expired timers going off the moment the machine wakes up, saying, "Oh, whoa, what happened? Oh, crap, I've got to do some work." Ultimately, all these tasks just start up at the same time. Your CPU utilization goes 100%. The user can't use the PC, etc. So try and be aware of that, that because that's likely to happen in the background, you don't. If you notice that all of the timers have expired at the same time, you probably don't want to have all the work happen at once. You want to prioritize what's going to happen. So for instance, in Outlook, you don't want to. The first thing you don't want to check the mail and the RSS feeds and calendar updates and whatever. Just probably people want to check mail first before they look for RSS feeds. Because for sleep, there's no veto for that. You got to make sure that you handle that well. You'll get maybe 2 seconds to clean up. But you can register for that event that sleep is about to happen, and you can do the right thing. If, as I said, it's really something that you don't want to happen because you're going to cause catastrophic data loss, then use that away mode request. There's another tool which is useful, and it's actually really designed for OEMs, but it can be useful for your own apps, is this power test tool. Will actually automatically put the machine to sleep and then wake it up again and back to sleep and wake it up again, so you can make sure your application actually stays stable during those transitions. This is actually a more of a problem, frankly, for driver developers than it is for application developers, because drivers tend to be a little bit more sensitive to those states, especially if, say, a USB device has been unplugged in the meantime. Don't do this. This is a classic case let's wait for something. Oh, just spin really fast waiting for it to happen. That is a terrible, terrible design principle. I hope I don't need to tell you that. You can do event-driven design, which essentially means that you're going to just sit there and register for an event notification to occur and get on and do the work then, as opposed to just waiting intently. Timer resolution. As I mentioned before, 15.6 is the default. You can drop it down to 1 millisecond. It kills battery life. If you are going to change timer resolution, make sure that you back off even in the middle of a task if it's no longer necessary. Lots of opportunities to do that. I work with Adobe on Flash 10.1. They were changing timer resolution and actually keeping the display awake. No, keeping the machine awake because of USB, or actually because of audio generally, and also not keeping the display awake. So they were failing on every dimension of this, and we actually got everything fixed in 10.1. So they're now the poster child for a good third-party application that's actually doing the right thing. And so this was one of the things that they were struggling with. And what they did actually with Flash Player, because it's also used, I know a lot of people just use it for video, but it's also used for Flash-based games. A lot of the games are not particularly written very well, and so they were aware of that, and so they actually dropped the frame rate when the tab was not active in the browser. So classic scenarios like your kids playing on your computer playing a game, and then you could, okay, you're done with that, and I want to use it now, but you forget to close that app down, and then meanwhile your battery life is draining really quickly because the tab, or the non-active tab, was just keeping the resolution set at 1 millisecond and the frame rate correspondingly high. There's this other technique, Windows 7, which is going to be particularly useful on the low power platforms, called timer coalescing. So this allows groups of scheduled timer events to all happen, all be serviced at the same time. And so essentially you're just, we're just trying to find the closest interval for a whole bunch of timers, and we'll service a bunch of them, as you can see that fancy animation there. Now, this is actually a pretty easy thing to experiment with. Essentially, if you're using the set waitable timer call today, you can just replace that with set waitable timer EX and provide another parameter, and voila, you've actually potentially fixed everything. Now, obviously, you want to test the application, but I think for the vast majority of apps, you can probably get away with this with no noticeable impact on the end user experience. And there's more of this. I'm not going to go into that detail. Register for power events, which we talked about earlier. We saw that AC-DC thing. The source code for that PowerMon tool has that capability. Extremely useful if you're doing something that's consuming a lot of resources. If you, for instance, were encoding video, you don't really want to be doing that on battery, and you might want to warn somebody that when they unplug their laptop, that, hey, by the way, we're still encoding, and this might not finish before your battery dies. More code on that. Similarly, the user can actually change the power scheme in Windows, and there's a way to actually say for the user to say, I'm going to be going to low power mode, and that's typically used by people who are on airplanes, for instance, and aren't going to be near a power supply. And so they'll actually change the power scheme, which ostensibly tries to be more aggressive with getting into low sleep states. It also a change will probably, based on how the plan is configured, reduce your display timeout and your system sleep timeout. But applications can actually also be listening for these events and change their behavior correspondingly too. And so that's maybe something else to consider if you really want to be, you know, extra considerate. All right, so a whole bunch of stuff on PCs. I'm glad there are a bunch of people developing apps that run on PCs. I want to sort of switch gears a little bit and talk about measuring power consumption. This is typically something that you want to do on server applications. Invariably, with client applications, you're not going to be running at a sustained load where this effort really makes sense. But for server applications where the whole idea is for them to be highly utilized and doing a lot of work, there's a really interesting opportunity to save energy and potentially get more done at the same time. So one thing that we notice in particular, though, is that a lot of performance testing that tends to occur happens at high load, which is not typical of even server applications. Most of the time they're idle. And so it's really important that when the system is idle, that your application is not creating a significant overhead energy for that application, for the system. And this is particularly important with virtualization, that if you've got a lot of machines that have been virtualized on the same machine, you don't want a lot of them having like high power idle scenarios, because that will reduce the ability to consolidate. And so we measure, I'm trying to think, is there another slide on this? That's the example. So we measure, if anyone's familiar with SPEC, they're a measurement benchmarking organization, and they have a benchmark called SPEC Power, which is very similar to what we do here in terms of just measuring the amount of energy that you use, it's really the power, you're taking the power reading, at any given load level. And you can just draw a nice graph, and a graph might look like this. So you can see, and this is just the effect of one change. So this was SQL Server using a 1 millisecond timer resolution on the red line, and then on the blue line. And you can see this was with I think it was 2008 hardware, so it would actually probably be even more dramatic today. You can see actually a pretty significant difference, the amount of power. What you should know about servers is that as soon as you turn them on, regardless of whether they're doing anything or not, they use a significant amount of power. Some of the older generation servers would use like 50 to 60% of their full power just by turning them on, even if they weren't doing any work. Later generations are maybe using 30%, so it's definitely getting better. But the thing that enables them to do that are these low-power processors and potentially low-power RAM that if the system is truly idle, will allow you to drop into a low-power state. If your application is, say, has a 1 millisecond timer resolution just on by default, that power is going to shoot way up, and that difference is going to be even more dramatic. The lower that power floor drops. So it's going to be very important for server applications in particular, and the client applications for the reasons I talked about earlier, to really make sure that at idle, you really are using a lot less power. I talked about Flash. In fact, I've already talked about SQL Server, so I'm not really going to go too much into detail on that. As you can see, we did a whole bunch of stuff with Flash to make sure that it really was a good power citizen on a laptop, particularly a laptop that's on battery, and also provide a great user experience. So this is sort of a little recap of what we've talked about so far. So be resilient and respectful of sleep transitions. Use the system availability request to make sure your application isn't impacted by sleep and the users have a good user experience. Supporting virtualization, I would hate to think there's anybody in the room that thinks they can write an app without considering that it might be virtualized, at least from the get-go. So that should go without saying. As we just talked about, measure that system utilization when your application is idle. You know, if there's, you know, you don't have to do the full-blown performance testing, but that's a really easy test to do. You can get a, you know, $30 or 30 euro power monitor, plug it into the back of the device, install the operating system, see how much power it's using, install your application, exercise it, and let it drop back down to idle, and then take a reading again. Those two numbers should be the same. If they're not, you've got a problem. You should look into it. Again, helping the system stay idle. So, you know, if you've got that problem, go fix it. Consider and adjust to the power environment. You know, if you're running on AC and it switches to DC, you might want to think about adjusting the way the application is behaving. Measure that workload power efficiency. So, you know, if you feel like you really want to go for it, actually see if there's a way you can get more work done with less energy. At least measure it to start with, and then improve it. Scaling resource use intelligently. So this is, you know, this is a number nine. It's probably unfairly at number nine, but this ultimately is probably going to require some help from a framework to let you do this. There are things you could do today to more effectively utilize those resources, but it's something I really want developers to start thinking about as a responsibility, and probably asking vendors for, like, please help me with this, as opposed to the vendors trying to force it on an unreceptive audience. And then cloud bursting. I didn't really talk about that, but this is the notion that, well, rather than me provisioning my IT infrastructure to handle my peak, I will actually provision it to handle my normal load, and then I will provision the peak load in the cloud. And I could do that by, you know, putting part of an application in the cloud, or moving an application from on-premise into the cloud, or just provisioning it in the cloud from the first place. So lots of different ways to leverage the cloud. But if the key requirement here is that you really write your application designed for the cloud, whether that's private or public. This is just another sort of a deeper dive on helping the system stay idle. Some things here we didn't talk about. One of my favorite is don't animate or output to the display when it's off. Seems kind of obvious, but you'd be surprised at how many applications do that. By the way, those little animations in the system tray, if you see those things flashing on and off, turn them off. Like, just for your own benefit, because they are probably preventing your system from really achieving its full energy efficiency and killing your battery life if that's what you're running on. Our guidance in Windows now is we don't have any animations going on. You can obviously have state changes, but just don't flick backwards and forwards, and the little dancing guys when they're doing virus scans and whatever else. Not a good use of resources. Intelligently schedule background processes. If you need to start up a background process to run periodically, we have a thing called the task scheduler. The task scheduler can trigger start tasks based on events, either when the system starts or when a user logs on or logs off or whatever. And you can also, like, say if it sees an event in the event log, you can run the task now. And this way, it's actually much easier for an IT pro or an end user to sort of control when those tasks run, as opposed to the thing being entirely opaque. And another thing which we haven't talked about, but really kills performance, is periodic disk and registry activity. If you're just, like, continually pinging the disk to look for changes, you're not letting the disk spin down. It's not such a big issue with SSDs, because the power differential between inactive and active is not that great on SSDs. But if you're using spinning media, it's huge. It's like on order of, you know, 3 or 4 watts on a mobile and 10 watts on a desktop. So really, you know, don't, you know, buffer those disk access requests if you can. And similarly with registry activity, as all that registry activity is back to disk. So that's a good thing to avoid. All right, so I'm pretty much done. I've got about 5 minutes for questions. I just want to just quickly, this is just essentially things you'll think about in the future. I'm going to actually skip past this so we actually have a chance for questions. Call to action, I think I've probably pretty much gone over this to ad infinitum. So some resources here. I post periodically, probably not as much as I could or should, on my blog, but if I'm inclined, I will talk about various energy efficiency things. Our ES team page has a whole bunch of guidance that we've collated around green IT and IT for green, if you're so interested. A lot of data center guidance up there in terms of how we run our data centers. The thing that you probably care about most is this Microsoft.com/EnergySmart link. That will send you to a page full of documents. There's actually three key documents. There's an Energy Smart software doc, a Science of Sleep doc, and a Timer Resolution doc. I can't remember what the title of that is. They're the three ones you should read if you really want a good recap of all the practices for what you should be doing around around system sleep on PCs. There's a forum that you can go and ask questions, and then the Orleans and Marlowe links. I haven't seen anyone taking pictures of the cameras. The IT guys are all about taking pictures of my slides. But hopefully you'll be able to pick this up in the recorded session. So last one, the tools, Power CFGs, it's in Windows, Power Tests. And the Power Event Monitoring tool is, again, on the... actually, I guess it's on the... yeah, it is. You can actually download it directly, which is actually kind of cool. You don't have to download the whole development kit. So there you go. So I've got a couple of minutes for questions, if anybody has any. Wow, I've like overwhelmed you, obviously. No questions? Did anyone find that useful? Apparently not. No. Okay, good. Yes. It does now. Well, YouTube, it's Flash. Flash. So Flash does do an... they do an availability request now in 10.1 and 10.2, which is the current release. So they didn't in 10.0. And so it was kind of interesting. Does anyone have any questions, or I'll tell you a fun little story? No? Okay, fun little story then. So when we were developing Windows 7, and I was dutifully dog-fooding Windows 7, I just started in the sustainability team. I've been in the team for about 3 years now. And you know, I was under the impression that we were really fixing power management in Windows 7 to be even better, etc. Except I noticed that my machine would never go to sleep. It's like, okay, this is ridiculous. I call them up and say, what's going on? I said, oh, it's probably, you know, something keeping your machine awake. Well, how do I do it? Power CFG request. Oh, right. That became the most commonly run tool I've ever used, I think, in Windows from that point on. I am now fanatical about it. Whenever I see a machine awake in my house, my desktop, whatever at work, I'm like, oh, it's awake. Why is it awake? And run Power CFG requests. Oh, look, it's this app. Oh, my God. So I have found so many bugs in our own apps and other apps because of this. And it was because of Windows 7. I used to have problems with Windows Vista not going to sleep. And there was literally nothing you could do about it. I mean, you had no idea why it was, you know, you could start removing apps, closing apps down, whatever. It never seemed to be a particularly efficient way of diagnosing. But this has really changed, and it changed my outlook on, oh, my God, developers really need to start being aware of this stuff. But what I realized is that unless the IT pros are complaining to the developers won't fix the problems because no one's complaining about them. What I'm trying to do is you know, drive that sense of annoyance with the end users and the IT pros so that they come knocking on your door. So you can hate me for that, but I think it will help us save more energy overall. So I'm not too ashamed. So. Anyway, thank you very much. Appreciate your attention, and good luck.